thoughts from last time. It's just a couple of verses between the incident that we considered last time and what we're going to commence with tonight. And that's in Matthew chapter 17, verses 22 and 23. The equivalent was Mark 9, verses 30 and 32, and Luke 9, verses 43 and 45. If we take Matthew's account in Matthew chapter 17, again we shall notice the reiteration of something which he had established and which he will continue to establish until his death. While they abode in Galilee, says verse 22, Jesus said unto them, The Son of Man shall be betrayed into the hands of men, and they shall kill him, and the third day he shall be raised again. And they were exceeding sorry. And constantly we're going to have this repetition of trying to get the disciples to appreciate that he must suffer in this way. If we have a look at the account in Mark, you'll notice that in verse 32 of Mark chapter 9, Mark adds the comment, verse 32, But they understood not that saying, and were afraid to ask him. So despite the constant repeating of it, the very principle of the transfiguration enforcing it, still they did not understand. And maybe there's a bit of light thrown on it by Luke's account in Luke chapter 9. Verse 43, And they were all amazed at the mighty power of God, but while they wondered every one at all things which Jesus did, he said unto his disciples, Let these sayings sink down into your ears, for the Son of Man shall be delivered into the hands of men. But they understood not this saying, and it was hid from them, that they perceived it not, and they feared to ask him of that saying. As if they'd got a mental block as to the reality of what the Master said. And he was obviously wanting them to ask him so that he could reiterate and explain it time and time again, that they might appreciate the truth of it. Now we're going to see this come up so many times during the last few months of the Lord's life, and it would seem that constantly they failed to understand. Anyway, these things were going on around Galilee. We're going to take up the next incident in Matthew chapter 17 from verses 24 to 27. It's only Matthew who records it. Neither Mark or Luke nor John make reference to the fact of the payment of the temple tax by that miracle of the money being in the fish's mouth. Now, the principle of this applied only, as it would appear, to Peter. Now again, there might be a very good reason which we will consider in a few moments. But the miracle was unique, I would suggest to you, because it's the only miracle in which the Lord Jesus himself was to benefit. Every other miracle he performed was for the benefit of others, not himself. This miracle is the only one that the Lord actually benefited. Now, it might not be in the direct positive sense of somebody being raised from the dead, but nevertheless, the principle is established that the Lord benefited from this miracle. Now, you know the incident, you know how the money was found, but I think there's a very important lesson which follows on from what we've just seen in verses 22 to 24, or verses 22 and 23. It's still going to be talking about and reinforcing the fact of what the Lord was to do. Let's just go through it briefly first of all. In verse 24, when they were come to Capernaum, they that received tribute money came to Peter and said, Doth not your master pay tribute? And the tribute money obviously goes back to Exodus chapter 30, with the payment of the half shekel of the sanctuary as a ransom money every time that the children of Israel were numbered. That's what the law of Exodus chapter 30, verses 11 to 16, was to say. Verse 12, when thou takest the sum of the children of Israel after their number, then thou shalt give every man a ransom for his soul unto the Lord when thou numberest them, that there be no plague among them when thou numberest them. This they shall give, every one that passeth among them that are numbered, half a shekel after the shekel of the sanctuary. A shekel is 20 gerahs, and a half shekel shall be the offering of the Lord. Every one that passeth among them that are numbered, from 20 years old and above, shall give an offering unto the Lord. The rich shall not give more, the poor shall not give less than half a shekel, when they give an offering unto the Lord to make an atonement for your souls. And you shall take the atonement money of the children of Israel, and so on and so forth. It was only when they were numbered. But by the time the Lord Jesus' ministry, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the hierarchy had taken hold of Exodus 30, misapplied it as usual, and they turned this poll tax into an annual affair. So everybody of Israel had to pay this half shekel every year to the temple. It was not only when they were numbered, it was now when annually the time of the year came about. Now apparently, according to Josephus, it was not compulsory, but it was considered a duty, and woe betide anyone who didn't pay it. So basically, to all intents and purposes, it was something which people basically had to pay. And so the question was to the master, or to Peter on behalf of his master, does your master pay this half shekel to the sanctuary? And Peter's response was quick and emphatic. He said, yes. Now, whether or not Peter said it to cover for his Lord, or whether he said yes he does because Peter had seen him pay this money before, because don't forget, we're now into the last year of his ministry, and therefore, you know, two or perhaps three occasions before, when this tax was collected, the master had paid, we're not told. It obviously troubled Peter. It either troubled him as to why the master was paying it, or it troubled him because he said yes when he didn't really know. And of course the master reads his thoughts. Verse 25 of Matthew 17. When he was come into the house, Jesus prevented him, saying, what thinkest thou, Simon? Of whom do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute? Of their own children or of strangers? And Peter's reply was obviously quite understandable. Peter said unto him, of strangers. Jesus said unto him, then are the children free. And that was a fact. The kings of the earth, the Romans, took tribute of strangers. It was the Jews and the other occupied territories who had to pay the custom to Rome. And therefore it really not the Jews that they had to pay this money, not the tribute money, but the tax to Rome on a regular basis. And therefore, Peter was obviously underlining the principle of the day that it was of strangers that this money was collected. So the master says, then are the children free. So the question was, ought we, Peter, to pay a tax to God? If we are to pay a tax to God, then we're not really part of God's family. Doesn't paying it, Peter, imply that whoever pays it is really a stranger from God, a foreigner? So basically, we don't have to pay, do we, Peter? Then in verse 27, before Peter could respond, he says, notwithstanding, lest we should offend, go thou to the sea and cast an hook and take up the fish that first cometh up, and when thou hast opened his mouth, thou shalt find a piece of money, that take and give unto them for me and for thee, lest we offend. Now again, brothers and sisters and young people, I'm going to give you two suggestions as to what he meant by lest we offend. Romans chapter 13. Verses 1 and 2. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. So unless it's contrary to what God requires of each one of us, then whether or not we think it's right or fair or otherwise, we should submit ourselves unto the higher powers. Now if we go over to the first epistle of Peter, Peter was to later on endorse this very principle. First epistle of Peter in chapter 2. And verses 13 and 14. He said, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be the king as supreme or unto governors, as unto them are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise that do well. So there's no real bother if we pay it, is there, Peter? So in case we offend, in case we upset them, we are showing that we're a law-abiding citizen, we are obeying that law which they have imposed. Now again, that could be the sense in which the Master implies it. Or it could be in the context of what we've been reading about in the Acts of the Apostles. Can we go to Acts 16 for a start? And it concerns the Apostle Paul with his son in the faith, Timotheus. In Acts chapter 16, it says, he came to Derbe and Lystra, in verse 1, and behold, a certain disciple was there, named Timotheus, the son of a certain woman, which was a Jewish, and believed, but his father was a Greek, which was well reported of by the brethren that were at Lystra and Iconium. Him would Paul have to go forth with him, and took and circumcised him because of the Jews which were in those quarters, for they knew all that his father was a Greek. Now the Apostle Paul obviously circumcised Timothy not for salvation's sake, not because it was commanded by the Lord. On the contrary, he'd gone against the principle of circumcision. And we know the very Jerusalem council, if we go back to Acts chapter 15, and verse 19, that the Gentiles were not commanded to be circumcised. They were only given those four things. But of course Timothy was part Jew as well as part Gentile. And just in case it upset the Jews, and therefore they would not listen to the Apostle Paul because he was associating himself with a Jew, he saw no harm in circumcising Timothy to get his message across. We just read to today, haven't we? Exactly the same situation. It's in Acts chapter 21. When Paul had come back from his missionary journey, and he had gone to explain to James and all the elders at Jerusalem what had happened amongst the Gentiles. And we find that in verse 21, James and the elders were concerned about the Apostle Paul. He says, they are informed of thee that thou teachest all the Jews which among the Gentiles forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children, nor to walk after their customs. Was it therefore, the multitudes must needs come together, for they will hear that thou art come. Do therefore this that we say to thee, we have four men which have a vow on them. Them take and purify thyself with them, and be charges with them, that they may shave their heads, and all may know that those things whereof they were informed concerning thee are nothing, but that, thyself also walkest orderly, and keepest the law. As touching the Gentiles, we believe we have written and concluded that they observe no such thing. And so, in accordance with what they have requested in verse 26, Paul took the men, and the next day, purifying himself with them, entered into the temple, to signify the accomplishment of the days of purification, until that an offering should be offered for every one of them. Now again, it didn't matter. It wasn't vital, it wasn't what God had commanded, but nevertheless, so that he could get his message over, and so nobody took offence, the Apostle Paul was willing to do it. I believe that both of those implications are in the Master's statement, lest we offend. There has got to be sense and reason that unless it's a vital principle, unless it really matters, there is no point in provoking people on certain matters just for the sake of it. Because if you do, and you push that point to the nth degree, they'll shut their ears to everything else that you're trying to explain to them or to teach them. And so that when it then becomes a vital issue, they don't want to listen anyway, because they say, oh, you're on your knees, I'll be yours again, or she's on her, I'll be yours. And the Master, quite the way through his ministry, didn't want to provoke for the sake of provoking, and this didn't really matter. He'd established the fact that he didn't have to pay it. But nevertheless, because the Jews thought he should have done, then he wanted to make sure that they hadn't got any point in which they could point the finger to him for no reason. Now, when he came to Sabbath law, when he came to other matters, then obviously that was a different principle. But this one really didn't matter. So it's a question of, don't create a precedent and a principle when there's no real need. And so, lest we offend, go to the sea and catch this fish, and you will find some money there. Now, of course, Peter didn't have to do that. They'd got enough money. You remember at the time when the Master had fed the multitude, they'd got 200 pennyworth at least to go and find bread, to go and buy bread. But of course Philip said that wasn't going to be enough. Judas was the keeper of the bag. The Master wasn't short, if I can use the expression, of a shekel. That money could have been provided, A, from the treasury, or he could have just clicked his fingers and a shekel could have been in his hand. He obviously didn't have to go through this elaborate process, but he does. So if he does, there must be a reason. So we've got to think of it from Peter's point of view. Where does he find the atonement money, the redemption money? He finds the redemption money out of the mouth of the fish. I'm going to give you no sign whatsoever but the sign of the prophet Jonas. As Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the fish's belly, and the resurrecting took place out of that fish's mouth, I believe it was for the very same principle that he was saying to Peter, you're going to find redemption out of this fish's mouth. But notice, when thou hast opened his mouth, thou shalt find a piece of money, that take and give unto them for me and for thee. Now in verse 24, the tribute money that they were talking about was half a shekel. In verses 27, the piece of money was a full shekel, because it was for thee and for me, Peter. So it was two half shekels. It was one shekel. So verse 24 was the half shekel. Does your master pay the half shekel? Verse 27 in the Greek is a full shekel. That take and give unto them for me and thee. The atonement money was for his disciple and also for himself. It was an atonement which he himself needed to share. And that's why I said at the outset of this miracle, it was the only one which the Lord Jesus directly benefited from, because there was necessary for him to make an atonement for himself as well as for Peter and the rest of his disciples. So give unto them for me and for thee. Now we had some discussion some time back when the December issue of the Christadelphian would seem to imply in the editorial that the Lord Jesus did not benefit from his own sacrifice. We had a long chat with Mike Ashton, and also others had, and we had in the April edition of the magazine a retraction or an explanation where he demonstrated that the Lord did benefit from his sacrifice. Now obviously that's a scriptural teaching, something which the Christadelphians have long believed in. It's been established constantly throughout the scriptures, and this very small miracle proves the fact that the Lord had benefit from his own atonement. Notice, not for us, Peter. I don't want you to pay the money for us. I want you to give it to them for me and for thee. There is a difference between the master and the disciples. He was a son by right. We are only by adoption. So the difference in the sacrifice was that he did no sin. We do many sins. And therefore, his sacrifice were far more efficacious, far as we're concerned, than for himself. Because his own sacrifice was not for his own sins or trespasses, because he committed none. It was because it was necessary, because he bore our nature, to receive benefit from his sacrifice. So Peter, notice the difference. It's for me and thee. Now while you got that in mind, brothers and sisters, can we come back to verse 22. The Son of Man shall be betrayed into the hands of men, and they shall kill him, and the third day he shall be raised again. Peter, this is not just for you. This is for me and thee. And for the first time, he was trying to explain to Peter, this sacrifice embraced himself as well as the disciples. And that's against the background of 1 Epistle of John chapter 4. 1 John 4. Verse 1. Beloved, believe not every spirit. Try the spirits whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. Hereby know ye the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesseth that Jesus Christ is come of the flesh is of God. And every spirit that confesseth not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God. And this is the spirit of Antichrist, whereof you have heard that it should come, and even now already is it in the world. So for his nature, for the very fact of his descendants from Adam, that he was born of a woman, it was necessary for the atonement, for the redemption, for me and thee. Can we go back, brothers and sisters, to the book of Psalms, Psalm 49. Because again, we've got a quotation which is often used back in Psalm 49. Psalm 49 verse 6, they that trust in their wealth and boast themselves in the multitude of their riches, verse 7, none of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give to God a ransom for him. So like the blood of bulls and goats could not take away sin, so no half shekel of the sanctuary, no atonement money could redeem one's brother. And therefore, the ransom that Jesus paid was without money and without price. It was his own life. And so when we come back to Mark's Gospel in chapter 10, this, as we know, is what the Lord was to say a little later on in his ministry. Verse 45, for even the Son of Man came not to minister unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. So his sacrifice was priceless. It was without money, without price. It was his own precious blood. But I want you to notice, because of the next incident which is going to occur with the disciples, that the Son of Man came to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. So why, brethren and sisters, coming back to Matthew chapter 17, did the Lord want Peter to go down to the Sea of Galilee, take a fishing rod, cast it into the sea, and catch a fish? Why didn't he just provide the money? He wanted Peter to realize in faith and to believe that redemption was being provided, but it was not just going to be given. There was effort required as far as the disciples were concerned. So the Lord didn't just create a piece of money. He didn't just make a miracle of a piece of money. He wanted Peter to realize there was effort and faith and belief on his part required. So Peter, in obedience to the Lord's command, went to the sea, cast his rod, and he found the money. Now, he could have thought, this is a bit daft. I'm going to look right stupid here, going down there, trying to catch this fish and to see whether the piece of money is in his mouth. But he didn't. He didn't hesitate. And I believe that Peter had the same faith here as where the other miracles were performed. Be it unto thee according to thy faith. If there had been any doubt, it would not have happened. And I would say, on the same principle, that's exactly the same as far as redemption and atonement for us is concerned. Unless we believe without reservation, have total faith that the Lord is able to cover our sins and our iniquities and to present us faultless before the presence of God's glory, then it won't happen. There has got to be this total belief in what the Lord is able and willing to do. Peter, you go and do that and give it unto them, for me and for thee. Don't doubt, make the effort, and just believe what I have said. It's a small miracle, if I can use that term. It's certainly a small incident, and yet probably contained a very, very powerful lesson for Peter. That he was involved in what the Master was going to do by going up to Jerusalem, being killed and being raised dead the third day. That out of the fish's mouth, out of the sign of the prophet Jonas, then redemption and atonement was going to be wrought for the Master and for his disciples, providing we're prepared to believe. So this takes us on then to the next of the incidents in the life of the Lord. And this time the three gospel writers, Matthew, Mark and Luke, record them. So the next section is in Matthew chapter 18, verses 1 to 7. Mark chapter 9, verses 33 to 37. And Luke chapter 9, verses 46 to 48. I'll repeat that. Matthew 18, verses 1 to 7. Mark 9, verses 33 to 37, Luke 9, verses 46 to 48. Who is going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And that was the concern of the disciples. If you, Jesus, are going to be king, and there's no doubting that, who's going to be next in line? Who's going to be at your right hand? Who's going to have the positions of authority? Who is going to be greatest next to you, Lord, when the kingdom of God is established? I want you to keep in your mind for a moment, why at this time should the question be asked? Can we go to Mark's Gospel, first of all? Mark chapter 9. Verse 33. He came to Capernaum, and being in the house, what house? I would suggest it's Peter's house. And he asked them, what was it that you disputed among yourselves by the way? There was only Peter involved with the atonement money in the fish's mouth. Did the disciples feel that the Master was selecting Peter above the rest? that Peter seemed to have special privileges, that the Master seemed to have more of an empathy with Peter than he did the rest? Was it that Peter, thou art Peter, I'm going to give you the keys to unlock the truth to Jew and Gentile? Peter on the Mount of Transfiguration, Peter now receiving the atonement money for me and for thee, Peter. Was the jealousy amongst the disciples that the one had been blessed and the other hadn't? And was it the fact that Jesus had chose to set up home in Peter's house? By this time he'd long left left Nazareth, and Capernaum he'd become his home base. Was Peter this special one? What was it that you disputed among yourselves by the way? And how bitchy brethren and sisters can be. And no doubt they had this concern in their own minds. But when the Master had read what was in their thoughts, we'll notice in verse 34, they held their peace. For by the way, they had disputed among themselves who should be the greatest. So we've got to think of the reason why at that point it should occur. Those are my reasons, that there was jealousy amongst them. But when the Master asked them the questions, they didn't answer at first. But if we go over to Matthew's Gospel now, in chapter 18, eventually they plucked up courage. Because in Matthew 18 and verse 1, we find now the disciples come unto Jesus saying, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? So eventually they had to say it. They knew the Master had read their thoughts, and therefore they said to him quite bluntly, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Can we go back to Mark's Gospel now? And look what Jesus does first of all in verse 35. He sits them down. And he calls the 12, and he saith unto them, if any man desire to be first, the same shall be last of all, and servant of all. Now again, we've got some very wise words in the book of Proverbs in this context. Can we go back to Proverbs chapter 16? Proverbs 16 and verse 32. He that is slow to anger, he is better than the mighty, and he that ruleth his spirit than he that taketh a city. Now if you link that with Proverbs 29, verse 23, a man's pride shall bring him low, but honour shall uphold the humble in spirit. That's precisely what the Master was saying. If any man desire to be first, the same shall be last of all and the servant of all. Honour shall uphold the humble in spirit. So what the Master was saying was a total reversal of human standards. It's exactly what the Gentiles would seek after. And sadly also the Jews, that they wanted the uppermost seat at the synagogue. They wanted the praise of men. They wanted to be first in everything. And if there's a spirit which prevails this age, it's just that. I want to be number one. I'm all right, Jack. It doesn't matter about anybody else at all. Whilst we're just in Mark, go to Mark chapter 10. The Master was to make reference of this a little later. Because he says in verse 43, whosoever will be great among you shall be your minister, and whosoever you will be the chiefest shall be servant of all. And the example, the Lord himself, because he gave his life and became a minister unto them. So to illustrate what he was saying, as the Lord so often used illustrations, we go back to Matthew's Gospel in chapter 18. And he was to use a little child. I've got no proof, but I believe it was Peter's child. We know that he was married. We know that it was possibly his house, more than likely his house. And I would think it was Peter's child whom the Master brings before them in verse 2. Jesus called a little child unto him. He obviously was known to the child, and the child knew him. And what a lesson to use the child of Peter to illustrate what he was going to say now. He set him, so it was a boy, in the midst of them, and said, "Except I say unto you, verily I say unto you, except you be converted and become as little children, you shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven." Just for a moment, can you keep your finger there and just come to Luke chapter 22? Right now, at the end of his ministry, verse 31, the Lord said, "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan hath desired to have you, that he may sift you with wheat. But I have prayed for thee, that thy faith fail not, and when thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren." Why should the Master use exactly the same word then to Peter as he does here in verse 3 concerning this child? What greater lesson could there be to Peter than to remember the words that Jesus had said of his own son? "Unless you become like him, Peter, you will not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Until, Peter, you're converted and become as a little child, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven." And can we progress that thought for a moment, brothers and sisters? It is sometimes suggested that conversion takes place once in our life. That when we come to accept the gospel message and are willing then to submit to it through the waters of baptism, that is our conversion. Repent and be converted. I believe, brothers and sisters, and young people, that there are many instances throughout our life when our conversion might take place. It might happen on more than one occasion. If you bear with me, can I go through Peter's life? And you might like to add to these, you might like to disagree with some of them. I think we've got in the Scriptures of Truth indications of how many times Peter had to be converted. Can we first of all go to John chapter 1 and verse 41? By no means do I suggest this is exhaustive, but I believe that all of these quotations was part of the conversion, the turning around of Peter to become more like his Lord. Here's the first occasion. John chapter 1 verse 40. "And one of the two which heard John speak and followed him was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He first findeth his own brother Simon and said unto him, We have found the Messiah, which is being interpreted the Christ. And he brought him to Jesus, and when Jesus beheld him, he said, Thou art Simon, the son of Jonah, thou shalt be called Cephas, which is by interpretation a stone." The beginning of the conversion. Here was Peter converted to following the Lord. Can we go to Luke's Gospel in chapter 5? And this is an incident we've seen before. It's when Peter had become exasperated with his master. He'd fished all night, and the master was saying, "Well, just loose down your nets again." And Peter was thinking, "Well, who's the better fisherman, you or me, Lord?" Anyway, he did, and we know what happened. And the response from Peter was in verse 8. "When Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' feet, saying," or Jesus' knees, "saying, Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." And that was a humbling experience for Peter. Another conversion. Come to Matthew chapter 16. Verse 23. After Peter had said to the master, "No, no, no, you haven't got to do all those things," what you've just said in verse 21. He turned and said unto Peter, "Get thee behind me, Satan, for thou art an offence unto me. Thou savourest not the things that be of God, but those things that be of men." Another part of the humbling of Peter, the turning, the converting. We've seen the one already in Luke chapter 22. Let's go to Luke chapter 24. Peter had denied his master three times. And in verse 12 of Luke 24, "Then arose Peter and ran into the sepulchre, and stooping down, he beheld the linen clothes laid by themselves, and departing, wondering in himself at that which was to come to pass." And in verse 34, "Those that found the 11 said unto them, The Lord is written indeed, and hath appeared to Simon." And if you remember, when we considered Simon Peter for 3 days, after the cock had crowed twice, all he wanted to do was to prostrate himself before his master and to plead for forgiveness, to be given one last chance, another turn in the conversion of Peter, because the master made a special appearance to him. If we go to the 1 Corinthians in this connection, 1 Corinthians 15, look at verse 4. "He was buried, that he rose again the third day according to the scriptures, and he was seen of Cephas." He saw Peter before the rest of the disciples. So this was again another turn in the life of Peter, another part of his conversion. We go to John's Gospel in chapter 21, and we see another turn of the cog. It's when Peter, "Lovest thou me more than these?" And we know what the answer was. And he says in verse 18, "Verily, verily, I say unto thee, when thou wast young, thou girdest thyself and walkest whither thou wouldest not. But when thou shalt be old, thou shalt stretch forth thy hand, and another shall gird thee and carry thee whither thou wouldest not." What the master was saying there, "Peter, you're going to have to suffer like I've suffered," from a disciple who said, "No, Lord, you're not going to suffer at all." A disciple who couldn't understand that the master had to go to Jerusalem and 3 days he was going to be in the tomb. He couldn't understand that, and yet now he accepted it of himself. And what had made the difference? Well, you look back at verse 3, chapter 21 of John. "Simon Peter said unto them, I go a-fishing. They say unto him, We go also with thee. They went forth and entered into his ship immediately, and that night they caught nothing. The next morning, of course, Jesus stood on the shore, and he called to the disciples, Have you any meat? And they answered, No. Well, cast the net on the right side, and you shall find." Notice now, they cast the net. No argument, no complaint, no saying, "Well, do you really know what you're doing, Master?" They obediently did what he said. And look at verse 7. "Therefore that disciple whom Jesus loved said unto Peter, It is the Lord. Now when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he girt his fisher's coat unto him, for he is naked, and did cast himself into the sea." Didn't try and walk on the water. He was prepared now to swim to his Lord. The turning had begun to have this effect upon the life of Peter, that he wasn't now trying to do what was beyond him to do. He'd been humbled sufficiently by all these conversions in his life. I don't believe he'd finished even after the resurrection of the Lord. Can we go to Galatians chapter 2? Galatians chapter 2. And we come to verse 11. "But when Peter was come to Antioch, I withstood him to the face, because he was to be blamed. Before that certain came from James, he did eat with the Gentiles. But when they were come, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing them which were of the circumcision. And the other Jews dissembled likewise with him. insomuch that Barnabas also was carried away with their dissimulation, their hypocrisy, basically. But when I saw that they walked not uprightly according to the truth of the gospel, I said unto Peter before them all, If thou, being a Jew, livest after the manner of Gentiles, and not as the do the Jews, why compellest thou the Gentiles to live as do the Jews? So even the Apostle Paul catches hold of him and turns him again. Peter had to learn the lesson constantly through his life, until his epistles reflect a converted man. Because if we go over to the first epistle of Peter and chapter 5, these conversions which happened in the life of Peter were constantly reminding him what the Lord had said. And so in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 5, Likewise ye younger, submit yourselves unto the elder, yea, all of you, be subject one to another, and be clothed with humility. For God resisteth the proud, and giveth grace to the humble. Humble yourselves therefore under the mighty hand of God, that he might exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. And that was the reflections and the wisdom of a man who had gone through so many conversions in his life. It wasn't the fact that as soon as he'd seen his Messiah, he was converted. And I would say the same goes through our life, and probably even more times than Peter. The exhortation, as far as Peter is concerned, he accepted and learned from the conversions. Question we have to ask ourselves, do we? The opportunity arises, but do we learn? The fact of what we have to learn is expressed for us there in verses 5 and 6. That we have to be converted like little children. Not childish, like we've said on many occasions, but childlike. Again, we look at James, James chapter 4. And verse 10, where James says the same thing. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he shall lift you up. So the whole time the Master was saying to his disciples, you've got to be as I am, servant to all. I came not to do anything but to give my life as a servant for you all, a minister. Remember those words of John chapter 13, used so often and quoted so often. But this is the essence of what he's saying in response to the disciples, who's going to be the greatest. Verse 4, He ariseth from supper, lay aside his garments, took a towel and girded himself. Verse 15, I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Let this mind be in you, who being in the form of God thought it not robbery to equal with God, and so on and so forth, but took upon himself the form of a servant. He humbled himself, and because he humbled himself, God exalted him. So what the Master was saying, be as I am, willing to serve the least of my brethren. Don't think you're important. Don't think that you have got to have the same jealousy among you. Be willing to serve in whatever respect or aspect that is in the service of the truth. Be willing to do it. Every member is important. Every work is vital. But if we come back to Matthew's Gospel and chapter 18 again, after putting the child, which to me would have been a tremendous lesson for the Apostle Peter, he says in verse 5, Whoso shall receive one such little child in my name receiveth me. Now that principle was taken up later on, and as we know, in the parable of Matthew chapter 25. But look at verse 6 for a moment. Whoso shall offend one of these little ones. So the little child in verse 5 is the little ones of verse 6. Now it would seem that the Master is taking the very thought here from the prophets. Can we go back to Zechariah chapter 13? Look at verse 7 for a moment. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, and against the man that is my fellow, saith the Lord of hosts. Smite the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered, and I will turn mine hand upon the little ones. And if you notice your central margin, it takes you back to Matthew chapter 18. Take heed that you despise not one of these little ones. And again, if we go back further in the prophets to Isaiah chapter 60. Isaiah chapter 60. To me, there's a marvellous quote here. Look at verse, we know the context of Isaiah 60. I won't go through it again, you know so well. But Isaiah chapter 60, look at verse 21. Thy people also shall be all righteous. They shall inherit the land for ever, the branch of my planting, the work of my hands, that I may be glorified. Now notice, a little one shall become a thousand, and a small one a strong nation. I, the Lord, will hasten it in his time. He will raise up, he will exalt, so that the little one become the strong nation. Despised and rejected by the world, the master's little ones will become the head of the nations. And therefore he says, who shall receive one such little one in my name, receiveth me. Now if we take on the principle of no respecter of persons, that there should be no regard one against the other, if you only love them which love you, what thank have you? The whole of the attitude of the Master is that we should be willing to serve in whatever capacity we're called upon to do, without respect of persons. And then in verse 6 of Matthew chapter 18, he makes this comment. Whosoever shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck, and that he was drowned in the depth of the sea. Now again, as always, I've got two thoughts as to what this might be. The millstone obviously is taken from the idea in Jeremiah, and obviously it were better that a millstone were hanged about his neck and he was drowned into the depth of the sea. Was the Master suggesting it was better that he died before committing the offence? Before offending one of these little ones, it were better for him that he died first. Or was it better if what he did could be remembered no more? I want to explain the last bit. Can we go to Micah, which we've looked at in another context many times before? Micah chapter 7. Think of what the millstone is. Think about what was drowned in the sea. Verse 18, Micah 7. Who is a God like unto thee that pardoneth iniquity and passeth by the transgression of the remnant of his heritage? He retaineth not his anger forever, because he delighteth in mercy. He will turn again, he will have compassion upon us. He will subdue our iniquities, and they will cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. So here we've got the depths of the sea. Look at the end of verse 6 of Matthew 18. Now Micah chapter 7 is in the context that God is willing to forgive us our sins, as if they were drowned in the depth of the sea, never to be remembered again. And is that what the Master is trying to suggest as far as verse 6 is concerned? It were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck, that he would drown in the depths of the sea, and that he would be remembered no more forever, that he wouldn't have to stand in the resurrection at the last day. That if he could have his wish, that he could just be blotted out from their memory altogether, that's going to be better for him because of the offence of one of these little ones. Now, either way, brothers and sisters, it's quite a telling exhortation that it's either better to die before we commit the offence, or it's better that it could be totally obliterated as far as our deaths were concerned. We would remain in the dust of the earth so that we wouldn't have to face judgment because of what we've done. So severe is giving offence to one of these little ones. So what's it mean to give offence in this way? The word offend in verse 6 means to put a stumbling block, to cause someone to depart from the truth, to cause someone to turn away from God, to cause someone to stumble and fall because of our attitude towards them, because of our jealousy, because of our spite, because of our envy, because we have offended them to that degree that they have turned away. It's no good saying it can't happen. Sadly, it can and has. But the Master is emphatic that if we are the cause of this offence, it would be better that a millstone were hanged about our neck. So what do we have to do? Well, Matthew chapter 18 goes on to explain what we have to do. We have to be reconciled with our brother. If he will not hear, we have to take two or more. Then we have to take the ecclesia. We'll look at this in detail. But the whole object of it is based upon what, again, I'm sorry to keep repeating it tonight, but the Master repeats it for emphasis, lest we forget. Back in Matthew chapter 5. Verse 23, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then and come and offer thy gift. Don't break bread unless you've got a clear conscience about whether or not you've caused or given offence. And the Master not only said it there, he's repeated it before, which we've seen, and he brings it now to the point that we get the picture, as we say in a modern expression, that so serious is this, it would be better for us either to have died before we commit the offence, or that we can just be dead and forgotten forever, and that we don't have to stand in judgment for it. And that's why we want to pick up the point next time, brothers and sisters, from verse 7 of Matthew chapter 18, about offences and what we should do if we do cause one of those little ones to offend.